I've learned that death is not the end of the new flesh.
Long live the new flesh. I was hoping you'd be back.
Welcome to the New Flesh Podcast. My name is Brett Arnold, at Brett Redacted on Twitter. I'm here with my co-host, Jesse Hassinger, at Rock Marooned on Twitter. And this is, of course, the New Flesh Podcast, a podcast about horror movies and all things tangentially related to horror, horror movies, and the horror lifestyle, which this week includes, I think the voting period is over, but I'm assuming everyone who's a listener of the show, everyone was chomping at the bit to vote for the Oscars fan favorite, and I'm sure everybody voted for Malignant, right? Everybody voted for Malignant. We're going to see Gabriel throw a chair at a presenter tonight and take an Oscar for the best fan favorite film. That's living the horror lifestyle this week. The Oscars are tonight. We did an Oscar episode on Friday. The Oscars have now happened as you're listening to this episode, but as of the recording, they are in like 8 hours, so we don't know what's going to happen. We've already gone over all of our picks on the Oscar episode, except I think we got to the end of it, and I feel like I was rushing through it, and I don't think I ever named my like actual slate of Best Picture nominees that include the horror lifestyle picks, so I think I'll do that at some point, maybe in a minute. Just to get that done, tick the box. What else are we talking about? We're here today for an interesting double feature that have nothing to do with one another. There are definitely other movies that we could have paired these one with the other to make them fit better, but that's okay. We're doing it based on what makes sense for us. And this week it is Master, which came out on Amazon Prime not this weekend, but last weekend. This is the second week it's out. It stars Regina Hall. It is on Amazon Prime. It is getting mostly panned by critics. It got panned by critics for the most part out of Sundance, which is why I didn't see it until late. We'll talk about that movie. I think it's really good. I'm not gonna tease you. I think it's great because I think the movie needs my support. I think the movie needs support. Generally speaking. And we are also talking about Everything Everywhere All at Once, the A24 movie that is now in very limited release and I think opens wide in a week or two. So heads up, if you haven't seen that movie and you want to go in blind, don't listen to that section where we talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once. I do think it benefited from me not knowing anything about it going in, for sure. But we will talk about it on here. We'll do some spoiler-free talk before we get to the spoiler stuff. But I'll say up top that I liked it with reservations. And on the Patreon this week, which will be up as of this recording, we are talking The Lost City, which just had it was expected to do well, but I would say it overperformed even those expectations. It's going to have like a $31 million opening weekend for Channing Tatum, Sandra Bullock, starring The Lost City. Channing Tatum, one of the last movie stars that can open a movie, along with Sandra Bullock, who's like low-key been opening movies for how many years? 30 years, probably. Mm-hmm. So it's, of course, I'm not surprised to see it do well, but I didn't like that movie, and everyone seems to, and I think it's crazy, to be honest with you. I think that the expectation for this movie, the bar is so low that everyone's giving it the 3 out of 5. It's fine. Good enough. Go see it. Pass. And I would argue it is not good enough. And I think people's expectations should be higher, is my point. And we will get to that on the Patreon episode where we talk about The Lost City. And what was the second movie I wanted to talk about on the Patreon? It wasn't The Outfit, but we will also talk about The Outfit. And it wasn't Windfall, but we'll also talk about Windfall. So there's a lot of stuff to talk about. But Jesse and I went and saw the new Richard Linklater movie, Apollo 10 and a Half, A Space Age Childhood, a movie I didn't know existed until it was already playing at the Alamo. So we went and saw it opening day with like two other people in the theater. And we'll talk about that. I have ahead of its Netflix release, I believe, on Friday.
Yes.
So I've talked a lot. What's up, Jesse?
Not very much. Just watching movies. I think Master is the only thing I watched this weekend besides Labyrinth, which I took my child to see. I guess we watched The Linklater on Friday, technically, so that counts. But it's been like a kind of movie light weekend, and now the Oscars are taking up our time this evening, so I'm not going to watch any other movie. You can see what a horrible compulsion it is that I list my weekend by like, well, what movies did I get to watch?
Well, I mean, that's all I do as well. I'm right there with you. It is currently Hollywood's biggest morning, and throughout this episode, we're going to transition into Hollywood's biggest afternoon. And by the time it's out, it will have already been Hollywood's biggest night. What a whirlwind.
And it feels so late this year. I mean, this is when the Oscars used to happen always, for my like entire childhood, but they moved them up at some point and it was such a relief. And now having them back in late March is like, it just feels like it drags on, doesn't it? I'm ready to start honoring The Lost City and Morbius for next year's Oscars.
Yes, when I said Hollywood's biggest night is upon us, I meant that it's the week of Morbius, and Morbius is almost here, finally.
Yes,
dropping on April Fool's Day, maybe. Nobody knows if it's a prank. We'll see.
It's going to be the Paolo spinoff. That's the prank from House of Gucci.
Oh my God, that
Welcome
would be
to Morbius.
Morbius, the family. I don't know what he says in that movie. Wow, Morbius is out this week. Jesse and I are seeing Morbius in the middle of the day on Wednesday. You know, you really know they're proud of a movie when they're screening it at 1 p.m. The day before it comes out. And this made me laugh. I don't know if it made you laugh, Jesse, but the press screenings since COVID have not provided us with plus ones, like sometimes they do. I would say the traditional thing is that you don't get a plus one if you're a critic invited to a screening at like a screening room, like
right.
a, you know, like a super early, generally more early than like the week of. But when they do like the big all media press screenings that are like at a movie theater, not a screening room, you're generally allowed to bring a plus one, especially for a movie like The Lost City, you know, where they would want you to like bring your wife and have a good time, you know. Yeah. And like for kids movies, I've never done it because I don't have children and I'm not just going to gather other people's children and take them. But you can take your kid to the kids' movies generally,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you can. They even to kind of sometimes if they really want to goose the family crowd, they'll say like, let us know how many people, you know. When I was a childless person, there was some animated movie that like my wife and my best pal in New York wanted to see. And I was like, let's just go. I mean, like they didn't say it has to be children. So I was like, I guess I'm RSVPing for three. And then we just all went one big happy family. My wife,
three
and,
adults.
And our same age child. And actually this is just a random anecdote, but like my wife got invited to screenings for Fantastic Beasts and she can't go, but I was like, I'll take my kid and see if I can review it. And she wants to see it. She loves Harry Potter. And so I RSVP'd and the person was, or I kind of said like, hey, my wife got this invitation, but can I go? I'm a critic, blah, blah, blah. And the lady was like, well, I'm only handling your wife's in a few other companies. So like, but reach out to the PR person. So I reached out to the PR person and they were like, you can go, but how old is your daughter? And is she vaccinated? And I was like, she's six and yes. And then they were like, oh, you know, I'd ask that you screen this separately for her. It's PG-13. It's a little, and I went,
oh my
like,
God.
And I was like, come on, man, this is a fucking Harry Potter movie. And I'm being told you can go, but that's just an annoying.
It's ridiculous. Like, these are ostensibly children's movies.
Well,
come on.
I does feel like these Fantastic Beasts ones are weird. I think one of my criticisms of the last one was like, I hate saying who is this for, but I was confused, honestly confused watching the second one because I was like, well, it seems like it's supposed to be like, oh, this is a Harry Potter story more adult oriented because it's about adults and not kids. And it's, you know, has a more history.
Presumably
and more.
They're after the crowd that grew up watching Harry Potter and still cares.
Right.
And
right.
wants to go see it, which I think like is a dwindling number.
Yeah, well, and then watching the movie, I was like, but this, like, no adult, I mean, so I'm sure some adults enjoy it, but I was like, no adult, this isn't sophisticated. Like, so what is this? It's not a children's, it's like a children's movie for adults, or an adult movie for children. In any case, I thought with that nebulousness, it wouldn't be a big deal to take my six-year-old, but I am not allowed, because there, I have no idea why, really. I guess, you know, they thought maybe she would burst into tears and ruin the thing.
They think you have a very ill-behaved six-year-old who's gonna, like, throw feces at the screen or something when the movie's bad.
It would just
which
ruin
they
it
know
for
it's
me,
bad.
Because I'd have to take her out if she started, you know, whatever. Anyway, that's just, that's all to say that it does vary. But yes, generally with these big wide release movies, they're pretty flexible about, oh, if you want to bring, especially if it's something that has any kind of, even something like a superhero movie, they tend to kind of assume you're going to want to bring either your spouse or your kid or whoever.
I just thought it was so funny that the first plus one I've gotten in like 2+ years or whatever is the one that's at 1 p.m. on a Wednesday where no one can go to that. And they know that.
Yeah.
Like, they know that no one can take off work in the middle of the day to go see Morbius except for film critics.
Yeah.
So it's a really like a, did we give you, it's a Schrodinger's plus one.
I joked with my wife. I was like, look, I know, you know, your schedule's relatively flexible. And like, she does cover some media stuff for her job. I was like, you can come with me. And she was like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. I'm not going to see Morbius with you. How dare you?
Yeah.
Morbius will be a trip. Middle of the day, Wednesday screening. So fucking funny. I forgot what I was going to say. I had other things to say, of course, very important stuff, but I forgot them. So we're going to go right into the news.
Yes.
And then we're going to get into the main events because Jesse, you've got some explaining to do, buddy.
I mean, maybe I have some explaining to you to do to why it is dumb to like this movie. No, I'm just kidding. It's not dumb to like this movie, but I'm happy to explain all the stuff.
Yeah, I would like you to, because I fully don't, like, I understand the what, like, wanting to feel that way about this movie, but I can't believe that people feel the way they do about this movie. And that's about Master, which we are talking about in just a bit.
And, you know, you said critically panned. It did. It is. I mean, because nothing is really critically panned ever. It's at like 70-something% on the Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It's one
of my bubble things where everyone I know did not like it.
Right. Well, it's also, I think it also, there was a, it had a very muted reaction out of Sundance. And it's funny how some things get like the rapturous Sundance response. We talked about this, I think, on the Oscars episode, and then they hit the regular audience or even just the broader film critic audience, and people were like, what the fuck? What were you guys on about? And sometimes stuff, because it hits muted in Sundance, when it hits the kind of more critics and broader audiences, people are like, what are you talking about? This is fine. And I think this got at least some of those reactions. It got, you know, I mean, it's not like raves or anything. It certainly has its detractors, but it, I think it not benefited, because it, you know, obviously you'd rather just have the really good reaction in the first place, but I think it probably benefited some from a kind of getting lost in the shuffle at Sundance.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll talk about it.
We'll talk about it, and we'll talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once, which, man, that movie is also going to be fun to talk about because I have opinions. All right, bits and pieces, baby. News of the week. Larry Fassenden and Glass Eye Pix are having a retrospective at New York City's Museum of Modern Art. Running March 30th through April 19th, the retrospective for Glass Eye Pix will run 26 feature films and numerous shorts, animations, and early works created during Glass Eye Pix's 37 years of operation. It will include Fessenden's directorial efforts, No Telling, Habit, Wendigo, The Last Winter, Beneath, and Depraved. And the retrospective, Oh the Humanity, is the title, includes works by directors including Kelly Reichardt, Ty West, Rick Alverson, Jim Mickle, films by up-and-coming people like Anna Asensio, Jen Wexler, Mickey Keating, Ilya Chakin, Joe Maggio, Glenn McQuaid, Graham Resnick. I had to shout it out. Larry is a friend of the show. He did it in maybe the first or second year of this show. Came to the Yahoo offices and did a podcast with me illicitly in the conference room, and then was mad at the company, I guess mad at me, but mostly mad at the company, because there was no recycling at the Yahoo offices, which, like, you know what? Good call. And
that
I'm pretty sure
surprising.
Well, I'm pretty sure they do have it now. So I don't know if it was Larry who made the impact. That's the new flesh bump for you. But Larry Fessenden said he's honored to have his collection of films recognized by such a venerable institute as MoMA. While I get to have my name in the title of this retrospective, it is in fact a celebration of all the artisans who have worked under the Glass Eye banner, the producers, crew members, actors, sound designers, blah, blah, blah. So if you're in New York, that's a great time, great opportunity to see all these great, iconic, indie New York scene horror flicks. I've seen them all. Jesse, have you seen any of those that I mentioned? Larry Fessenden indies?
I feel like maybe not that many. So I think,
yeah,
I might check it out.
If you're at MoMA, check them out. There's some good stuff in there. The trailer for the new Alex Garland movie Men dropped. I haven't watched it because I refuse to. I actually was at, I forget what movie I was at. I was at, Evil Dead 2 at Alamo the other night. And they played the trailer and I had to look away. But at Alamo, it's easy to look away. I just looked at the menu. I was like, pickle fries. But yeah, A24's Men, directed by Alex Garland. The trailer's out. I'm not even going to read the description because I don't want to know shit. I'm all in. The movie's out May 20th. And look out for that trailer if you're interested. Nicolas Cage interview, not that interesting. Archive 81, a Netflix series that I heard about because it was executive produced by James Wan. It's an Atomic Monster production. A lot of people I know said it was actually quite good. It was in the Netflix top 10 when it came out. And despite all that, it did not meet the threshold Netflix set for the series based on its budget, which is how Netflix crudely determines how they greenlight things. And the 8-episode show has been canceled. It's an 8-episode season one based on a found footage podcast of the same name. I will watch it because I hear it's worth watching, but it's a bummer that that show ended. From what I can tell, it's a good show, and I'm excited to watch it. I guess I'm part of the problem. I didn't watch it.
Well, you know, a system that demands everyone watch everything immediately and binge it, which is what Netflix prefers, doesn't set up anyone up for success.
Yeah, it's not great. Are You Afraid of the Dark returned in 2019, and apparently there was already a second year called Are You Afraid of the Dark, Curse of the Shadows, which I did not see, but I did see the first season. I forget what it was called, but it was good. Apparently the third season's coming, and it's called Ghost Island, and it will follow new characters who think they're attending a fun vacation on a resort island. I think these are on Nickelodeon. So I remember having to download like the Nickelodeon app and watching season one on there, which felt creepy. But I will do that again and catch up with the show. I thought it was good. As someone who grew up watching the show in the 90s and as a horror fan as an adult, you know, it scratches the itch. I don't know if does your kid interested in the horror lifestyle, Jesse?
It's weird. Some things she doesn't want to see anything with blood. We watched Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi movie, and I was like,
oh yeah,
gotta
there's some blood in there.
Yeah, I was like, you're going to watch Spider-Man 2, because I'm like, catching up with all the Sam Raimi movies. I'm going to do a podcast episode about it on my other podcast. And she was like, well, I don't want to watch it. The first one had blood. She's like, means like there was blood around someone's mouth or something. Wow. But she likes some things that are sort of ghoulish. When she was a baby, she was really into like Nightmare Before Christmas and, you know, like the box trolls and like some other kind of things like that.
Oh, yeah. All the children's favorite, the box trolls.
I love box trolls. It's so good.
That to me is like modern The Borrowers, because I have no idea what that is.
It's so good. It's a like a, you know, it's a stop motion cartoon from Laika. That's really good. It's probably my favorite of theirs.
Okay. 2014 and, made $108 million.
Who knows? It's delightful. I recommend it. It's great. So, you know, the Coraline and Kubo and the Two Strings guys. So there's certain things. I think she likes certain kind of sometimes makes allusions to ghosts or kind of ghoulish things, but anything that when we describe, she likes us to describe horror movies to her that we've seen and talk about what they're about. And then I'm like, oh, you want to watch that kind of jokingly? And she's always like, no.
So she's like one of those people who's going to like read Wikipedia pages of horror movies
maybe.
And not watch them and be like, yeah,
it could be.
There's a podcast called Too Scary Didn't Watch that I'll give a plug on this podcast because I really like it. And it's these three women who one of them loves horror movies, the other two don't, and it's the premise is just like basically they outline the idea to them, and the other person just goes, no way, I would not enjoy watching that, and it is really great. But yeah, that's funny. I only asked because I guess 6 years old is not the demo for Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yeah,
I was probably watching that at like 12.
Yeah, I feel like my younger siblings watched that when they were tweens or a little younger maybe.
It was scary, and the new ones, it was solid. It was solid. Escape Room Tournament of Champions is hilariously opening in China in April. I just thought it was funny to mention. It never got a release in China. Almost a full year after it was out here, it is now coming out in China. The first Escape Room made $33.9 million in China. So that's not, that's not peanuts.
You know, it's not, it used to be pretty normal for stuff to come out these, like, with these 8 or 10 month delays, for in other countries. It used to be much more spread out. When I was like a teenager, I remember I was in England, I went to England with my family, and they were getting a lot of stuff like 3-4 months more after, stuff that had played in the US already was just like just making it over there. So it's
the whole nation is a second run theater.
You could have almost said that like Bill Maher or something. It was good. like the right snide. Yeah.
New rules.
Yeah.
not.
No, but yeah, it's like it's a real retro move for China to suddenly randomly get Escape Room 2 on the normal like 8 month delay. I wonder. Well, do you know if the previous one did well there?
33 million.
Yeah, not bad.
It's not bad. The question is it the orphan cut or the regular cut?
Yeah, it's almost certainly the regular cut, right? And then probably a few more minutes cut down if there's any allusion to talking animals or your horrible Western god or whatever.
Yeah, they got to China-proof it for sure. Yeah, it might be shorter. We'll keep you posted. If there's any new Flesh listeners in China that can report from the theaters in China,
yes,
let us know.
Please.
Apparently, we have a lot of listeners across the world, if these SoundCloud metrics are right. So make yourself known. I'll use this opportunity to say, give us a 5-star review on iTunes. I read them all, and I'll even read one right now. We got a new one on Wednesday from Peter A. Carbonaro. He said, by far my favorite horror-related podcast. The combination of deep film analysis and the lighthearted banter between Brett and Jesse makes it an enjoyable listen. Oh. Highly recommend if you're a real horror fan. Thank you, Peter. We agree.
Yeah, that's
Nate
that's very
Dude.
Nice.
Yeah, it is very nice. Nate Dude FX wrote, "I like this show. It's true. I like this show." Thank you, Nate. That's great. 5-star review. That's all we're asking from you. We don't need a lot. Al543670 says he never misses an episode. Even if I haven't seen the main event, gotta get my horror news. Great guests, sharp commentary. And he's got a recommendation. If you keep covering series, we should do Rec at some point. REC.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've only seen the first Rec.
Ooh,
American remake.
Yeah, the American remake was called Quarantine. It starred Jennifer Carpenter, I believe.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah, me too.
I love those movies. The Rec movies are great. If you've never covered them, I guess they were out before we started the show. That's a great recommendation. Maybe we'll do it. I will also use this opportunity to tease. I'm thinking about doing the Evil Dead series next because I think it's hilarious that Blank Check's doing Sam Raimi. The Halloweenies podcast is doing the Evil Dead franchise. And since we're the franchise podcast that started it all, of course, before all the other ones that came out a year or several years after us, I think it'd be really funny if we also just did the Evil Dead because I'm rewatching them anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll do Evil Dead soon.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll do Rec. And there's also a very special Patreon subscriber who, God love him, subscribed to our $100 tier.
What?
That's Spencer Davison. Thank you, my brother. Thank you so much. But that means he gets to choose a movie and talk about it on the show with
us. Oh, wow. That's cool.
So I believe we're going to be talking about American Psycho at some point.
Oh, that's so fun. I haven't seen that movie in ages, but I like it so much. So I'm excited.
Yes, I actually just bought it again for probably the third time in my life on 4K because the DVD or the Blu-ray I have is famously, in my memory, scratched and does not work. So I will, I did replace it for this. I mean, I got all that Patreon money. I had to. I had to buy it again. So I say all this to say, we're out there. We hear you. We're listening. You can be a part of the show on Patreon. You can be a part of the show just by reviewing it on iTunes, and I'll read it. Nelson dropped us a line. Nelson said that we're the best buddy duo since Jason Segel and Paul Rudd, and I love you, man.
Great That's high show. Praise from Nelson.
That's high praise. great show, great people. I'm not going to read his complaint about our mic levels because I fixed it, I hope. We do a great job of dissecting horror, says Adam Ska. He likes my energy. Really appreciates the spoiler warning. Jesse, you got to fucking get your energy up.
Yeah,
didn't say anything about your
energy. Yeah, gotta get amped. Gotta get amped. Yeah.
Let's go. This how funny would it be if I read this whole name of the person? They're FKFHDJJ, all gibberish. Amazing podcast. I listen to it at work basically every day. For newcomers, there are 6 years worth of content to browse through. The hosts bring great energy. Oh, wow. There you go. Jesse, you've got great energy. And are really fun to listen to, whether talking about horror or not. Highly recommend. Thank you, guys. This is all great. There are so many more. And I don't know. I'll read them if you want me to, but this seems like crazy to keep going. But please. Please keep it up. We're at 157. We're trying to get to 200. Hashtag race to 200. Let's go. Jennifer Tilly will return in season 2 of Chucky. That was confirmed. The Batman deleted scene was posted online by Matt Reeves. Did you see this? Did you watch this?
Yes, I did.
Did you guys hear about this? Yeah, so Matt Reeves, he had said that there was a long scene with the Joker that was cut from the movie. I'm going to go ahead and say it was rightfully cut from the movie.
Yeah.
It is kind of a fun little Easter egg. What did you think of this scene?
Yeah, same. Like, I saw someone say, and I get the argument that, like, why, you know, the movie's 257. Does it really matter if you have this 5-minute scene? But it does drag, to be honest.
It does.
It's a draggy scene.
I had to
scene.
Skip through the YouTube clip.
It doesn't really add much. If you're going to have a subplot with this character, it would add something, but it really, he tells Batman almost nothing. It really doesn't deepen anything. It does make, I think the only reason to keep it in would be to make, besides that people love the fucking Joker and want to see him and everything, to make that scene towards the end with him and the Riddler feel less like a kind of cheesy sequel tease, it would accomplish that.
That's true.
But they, I think they were willing to let that happen because who cares about the sequel teases being really blatant except like cranks like me. But it's kind of a cool scene on its own. It just like doesn't, yeah, it's a, you know, Reeves is a smart guy. He was smart to cut it.
Also really smart to just like put it up online and rack up the views and the every headline. Everyone wrote it up. It's just really smart marketing. But what did you think of Barry Keoghan generally? Like, I have this problem where why is everyone still chasing Heath Ledger Joker?
Like, yes.
It's pretty crazy that it seems like it's just that again, right? Like, he's really just doing that. And like, even the design of like the look of him, they're very teasy about it. Like, it's all through blurs and they occasionally get really close up and you see really, really how fucked up his scars, quote unquote, like they, you know, the famous how'd I get these scars in Dark Knight are nothing compared to how janked up hashtag horror lifestyle his jaw is here.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly, I could be wrong because I've been in and out of the comics for so long, but the whole, maybe there's a comic that has him having like the mouth scars and there is.
My buddy's been saying, I just want to return to comics accurate Joker. And they're just not doing that.
Well, and like, I don't even care about the accuracy just like so much as to have it all based so transparently on this one. Like, no one was doing Nicholson Joker. When in subsequent Joker, you know, the comics, the Joker in the comics, when I was reading the comics in the 90s, wasn't redone to look like Jack Nicholson because that would be ridiculous. And it wasn't redone. Maybe he veered a little closer to like the Mark Hamill animated series Joker in the comics, but like in the comics, they really have even sometimes made him look a little more like Heath Ledger. It's always got to have the matted and stringy hair and the scars and the mouth and the patchy makeup. And like, that's a great, I mean, it's so good in Dark Knight. I just rewatched Dark Knight fairly recently and it was, he's great. He's so good.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's a great design too. It's the makeup and stuff is all fantastic.
The jacket.
Yeah. All of it just is really well done. So it's nothing against Heath Ledger or the creative team on Dark Knight, a movie I genuinely think is wonderful. But yeah, you gotta do this. Like, it's to the point where I'm looking at Jared Leto's Joker, and that was like hilariously transparent in its attempt to imitate the Ledger voice. But now I'm like, well, at least he like had tattoos and slicked back hair. Like, it was stupid looking, but at least it was a different design.
Yes, at least it was its own thing, even if it was also still very Ledger-y.
Just you know, put him in like a suit and slick his hair back and make him a little more chillingly like, I don't know, like slick looking or smooth looking. I don't know.
I feel like it's not crazy to say most people, a lot of people's favorite Joker, even ahead of Ledger, is like the cartoon Mark Hamill version.
Yeah, and
like,
I think to a me, lot of the that hardcore is Batman people, that's their favorite. Yeah.
Yeah, and like I think that's because doesn't to me that means like I see like the comic, that's how I've envisioned like the comic Joker. Like he's kind of like tall and wiry, you know?
Yeah.
And like yeah, he looks like the long-faced clown. It's like it's so different from what the modern take on Joker is.
Yeah. That's people are chasing, you know, Ledger did win a posthumous Oscar for it and I'm sure part of it was trying to honor his memory, but and Joaquin Phoenix won an Oscar for playing, again, not completely.
He won an Oscar for two people won Oscars for playing the Joker.
Yeah.
We have to reckon with that as a society.
Yeah, and like it's even in the fucking Snyder cut of Justice League, they bring the Joker back at the very end for a horrible tease that's like the worst thing in the movie, and they kind of fuss with him to make the design more look more like the Ledger Joker. It's so fucked up. There's so, and like, and again, the Joaquin Phoenix, like obviously he's a very different style performer than Heath Ledger in that movie. He's trying to do something different, but a lot of it is just kind of bit from what Ledger's doing. You know, they even have like the shot with his head against the window in the car, which is not exactly the same as Ledger putting his head through the window of the cop car in Dark Knight, but it's close enough, guys. Like,
yeah,
let's just, nothing against what's his name? Not King of
Barry Keegan,
but better known as a guy whose name I'm forgetting from Eternals. I don't remember. It was gonna be funny, but now I can't remember his name.
It's okay, we've all been there. We love people, love your energy,
yeah. Some people like it okay, I think is what we're getting for the reviews. But yeah, like he's fun. You know, I could see Keegan being good at it. Like he's really creepy as fuck in Killing of a Sacred Deer.
He's great in Killing of a Sacred Deer, and he's so funny to me. And like how annoying he is in The Green Knight is so funny.
Yeah, that's probably my favorite performance of his. But like there's none of that energy in this clip. It's just more like, you know,
he's doing Heath Ledger Joker. It's Barry Keegan doing Heath Ledger Joker.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I was expecting, but I definitely was expecting it to be more Barry Keegan-y, I guess.
Yeah. More Druig, more of that Druig magic. That's the name.
God, Druig to me is like the funniest thing on earth, that like that's a character that has a toy and like exists or whatever. But like I don't remember Druig like emoting. Is that like a joke in the movie that he doesn't emote?
He's kind of like he's kind of aloof. Yeah. He's like kind of a dick. Yeah.
Yeah. Weird movie. That was Eternals, by the way, if you have no idea what we're talking about. Back to the horror news. Mandy director Panos Cosmatos is setting up a new fantasy nightmare movie at A24. It's called Necrocosm, spelled Nekrokosm. Very hashtag horror lifestyle title. Necrocosm's logline is being kept secret, but it's described as a phantasmagorical fantasy nightmare set deep within a strange galaxy where two lovers are torn apart as they try to survive a malevolent invasion.
Oh, wow.
Sounds like a Panos Cosmatos movie.
Yeah, yeah.
He did Mandy and Beyond the Black Rainbow. Beyond the Black Rainbow, I can only describe as the THX opening logo noise as a movie for 2 hours. Watch it and get back to me and tell me if that's a good description.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
I didn't like it that much, but there's a lot of horror fans who like think it's one of the best horror movies of the modern era. Like,
I feel like it's the same way with Cage People and Mandy. I like Mandy, but like
I like Mandy.
Joe's better, Pig is better, you know.
Yeah, I agree, those are better. I think in terms of horror Cage, like, it doesn't get better than Mandy, because people said Color Out of Space was better, and I disagree. I think Mandy's better. Uh-huh. But Mandy is two distinct halves, you know? It's like one half this trippy, I don't even know how to describe it, slow burn, and then the second half is like, oh, here's the Cage movie you ordered.
Yeah. With the chainsaws.
I really liked it. It's playing at Alamo, and now that I'm a season pass Alamo member, I'll probably go if it's nice on a night that works. Shout out to Alamo. $30 a month, unlimited movies, which is a great deal. So there's a deleted ending of the movie Blade in 98 that teased Morbius. Did you know this?
No.
So there's apparently really shitty footage from, like, you know, like work print shit from New Line. You can watch on YouTube. I'm trying to get to the meat of this.
They tried to warn us. They tried to warn us about Morbius.
To refresh him, Blade as we know it ends with the vampire hunter and the human Karen emerging onto a rooftop after their battle with Deacon Frost. Karen, who has cured herself of the infection, offers to help cure Blade as well, but having had his bloodlust reignited, he only suggests she make him a stronger serum instead, as he still needs his abilities in order to do his job. The movie then cuts to Moscow, where we see Blade set to take out some Russian vampires. Initially, in the deleted ending, the rooftop scene went on a little longer. Blade still tells Karen to keep her cure because, as she says, I still have a job to do. This time, Karen then tells him, you're on the clock, revealing a figure watching the conversation from atop a nearby building. That figure is none other than Morbius. All in all, this blatant sequel tease of an ending might be a little too on the nose, but it's also deliciously cheesy. A higher res version never surfaced, but you can watch it online, and it truly just looks like a guy in a cape standing on top of a building. Like, it looks really, really lame.
Oh, that sounds fun. I'm going to check it out.
Yeah. The question, so what happened? Why was this amazing setup scrapped? David Goyer on the DVD commentary said, the ending was meant to set up a sequel in which Morbius would be the main antagonist. That was Goyer and director Stephen Norrington's idea and would have formed the backbone of his sequel. But when Norrington left, that idea left with him. Guillermo del Toro came on board to direct Blade 2 instead and naturally did his own thing. That is nuts to me. I never heard this before. I love Blade. I think I'm on the podcast on record as saying I rewatched both of them, and conventional wisdom would tell you that the sequel's better, right? Everyone says Blade 2 is better. It's a Guillermo del Toro movie. I disagree so hard. I think Blade 98, or is that 98? Is that right?
98, yep.
Mm-hmm. I think Blade 98 is not only one of my favorite superhero quote-unquote movies ever, I just think it's so good. One of my favorite horror movies, even. And Blade 2, it just, like, it has really bad CGI rubbery shit that aged really poorly. The first one just doesn't have that problem. And I think Blade just holds up, and people don't remember that how good it is because they are always talking about Blade 2. That's my note for the day, is to watch Blade. So you're into that. Would you have been into a Morbius? I mean, that sounds like modern superhero thinking.
It does. It's 98. So funny how these things, I mean, you do hear a lot about, like, I think there at some point there was a thought that they were going to try to work out. I think Hugh Jackman was even on set on Spider-Man in 2002, or Spider-Man 2002 would have been on set in 2001, to do a Wolverine cameo. Just kind of like, yeah, why not? And then it didn't, for whatever reason, it didn't work out. So it's funny that these things were always sort of floating around, that you would tease these things or have a cameo or interconnect them in what was then a much more haphazard way. I mean, like, they make reference to Doctor Strange in the first Spider-Man movie. And, like, it was just sort of tossed off. So it's fun to see that those things were always sort of, it even goes back to, like, the Batman movies. They talk about Metropolis briefly, like, the, you know, halfway to Metropolis by now. Right. So, you know, it's been in there, but it is wild to see that, like, Blade was going to do the full on cheesy sequel tease. At the time, I would have been like, what the fuck? Because even as someone who read comics, I didn't know that much about Blade or Morbius. So, like, I imagine that it is funny to see, like, because those things get that reaction sometimes now, but there's enough faith that, like, well, certain people are going to go crazy for it. And I think in 1998, there was, like, that those certain people would be so few and far between that they were like, it's not worth it. Who cares?
Yeah. I just think it's so funny. I've said it on the podcast again before, but I'll say it again, that Sony being rewarded with their really crude gamble to like make that Venom movie that's like, you know, we'll do we don't own Spider-Man. We own the Spider-Man villains. We can make Spider-Man villain movies without Spider-Man. It'll work, right? And it's just such a dumb idea, and I'm so mad that Venom was so huge it sparked Venom 2, which was even bigger or whatever. And now we're getting Morbius, which was like, this one's not going to do very well, right? Like, it was long delayed.
I don't know. I'm like, people go see this shit. I kind of feel like it'll do okay, but who knows?
Yeah, maybe you're right. I think, I just think it's funny that we have to now live in a world where we get Venom, we get Morbius, we're going to get Kraven the Hunter. It's just wild that, it's a perfect example of like a Hollywood executive decision that would normally be panned because it's like so crass and stupid, that of like a cash grabby thing, and like to have it work out is so frustrating, you know.
Yeah, it's very strange. And the weird thing is they do own the rights of Spider-Man, but they like leased it back to Marvel under this agreement to put him in these Marvel produced ones,
right?
And at some point, like, they're not going to ever let go of Spider-Man. Like, this is just encouraging, you know, and the fact that they can build these other movies around it means that they will never ever say, we don't need the rights of Spider-Man anymore, which in a perverse sort of way I sort of enjoy, just because I was like, yeah, why should Disney own every single goddamn character? why shouldn't Sony be allowed to make weird misbegotten Spider-Man spinoffs and stuff? But it sucks that that's the main alternative to like Marvel stuff right now. Like, the only thing that's not, that basically that doesn't have a, where Disney doesn't have a stranglehold on the character, is like side characters from Spider-Man. That's a shame.
Yeah, it's very strange. And look forward to Madam Web starring Dakota Johnson or whatever. Yeah. Radio Silence is already teasing Scream 6, which has a release date of March 31, 2023, just about a year from now. Here's what they said, chatting with Empire Magazine. This movie has to be willing to risk it all in order to subvert all those expectations. And we're so far down the rabbit hole of Scream movies that it's all up for grabs at this point. Just a quote that means nothing that gets me excited. I would have to share. Did you see the first pictures of Nicolas Cage as Dracula?
Yes, of course. Yes.
What do you think of the look? How would you describe it to somebody if they didn't have the photo in front of them?
I would describe it as Christopher Lee-esque. I mean, yes. I'm not in no kind of Hammer horror expert. I bought a bunch of them and haven't watched them yet last Halloween. This Halloween, I'll do it. But yeah, it reminded me of Christopher Lee. And when I've seen bits of the Christopher Lee Hammer movies, I was like, oh yeah, he's, and knowing that Cage likes Christopher Lee, I just made that connection because of that. I'm reading the book that Keith Phipps wrote about Nicolas Cage right now. It's very entertaining. Oh, wow. He mentions Christopher Lee in it. So yeah, I was like, yeah, it's kind of Christopher Lee. It's kind of like heightened. It doesn't look super cartoon.
It's got it's like a red velvet suit.
Yeah, it's obviously very heightened and crazy, but I'm hoping it's not going to be just, I know this is supposed to be sort of a comic version. I'm hoping that Cage usually takes this stuff seriously, even if he's in something silly. So I'm excited. It made me excited, basically.
The plot is very strange. The film is called Renfield. Reminder, it's not a Dracula movie. It's a Renfield movie. Modern day adventure story that is comedic in tone. Film centers on Renfield, Nicholas Holt, who has grown sick and tired of his centuries as Dracula's lackey. The henchman finds a new lease on life and maybe even redemption when he falls for feisty, perennially angry traffic cop Awkwafina. Such a weird premise. Anyway, The Northman, the Robert Eggers movie coming out next month. That's an action-filled epic following a young Viking prince on a quest to avenge his father's murder. It has been rated R for strong bloody violence, some sexual content, and nudity. The movie stars Alexander Skarsgård, Anya Taylor-Joy, Nicole Kidman, Ethan Hawke, Willem Dafoe, and Bjork. Holy shit.
Yes.
What a cast. What a cast. The film is directed by Robert Eggers, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Icelandic poet and novelist Sjón. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's S-J-O-N with an accent on it. Icelandic style. The Northman is definitely a top anticipated movie of the year. How about
yes.
you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It looks fucking awesome.
I haven't even seen the trailer because I'm avoiding it, and I still feel that way. Looks great. Evil Dead Rise, which is the HBO Max direct, I believe, Evil Dead movie coming next year, or coming this year, directed by Lee Cronin. Rated R for strong, bloody, horror, violence, and gore, and some language. In the fifth Evil Dead movie, a road-weary woman pays an overdue visit to her older sister, who is raising three kids on her own in a cramped LA apartment. Their reunion is cut short by the discovery of a mysterious book deep in the bowels of the building, giving rise to flesh-possessing demons and thrusting the woman into a primal battle for survival. So basically, the idea of this movie, as far as the title can tell you, it's Evil Dead, but instead of a cabin in the woods, they're in like a high-rise building. I think that's a great idea. I've said it over the years. Any time a movie comes out that I have sketched in my iPhone notepad from the past 10 years of horror screenplays I never wrote, one of them was a high-rise slasher movie. But this is better. Evil Dead in a high-rise is an improvement. Yeah. So I'll let that one go. I had nowhere to go with it other than gentrification, building, horror. Yeah. I could have sold it to like A24. You know?
I feel like you could have sold it to, well, it's like
the antebellum people.
I was going to say, whoever made Master, maybe.
No, fuck you, boo. The Master is so much better than people are giving credit for. I can't wait to talk about it. Christina Ricci, did you hear this? Will appear. She's not going to be Wednesday Addams. Right. But Christina Ricci, famously Wednesday Addams, will be in the Wednesday Addams show, in which Wednesday Addams is played by
Jenna Ortega, Scream Queen 2022.
That's right. She's not playing Wednesday. Details about Ricci's role are being kept under wraps to protect the surprise for fans, but she plays a new character, not an older version of Wednesday. She's been quietly filming on it for months, and it only just broke. She last worked with Tim Burton in 99 on Sleepy Hollow.
Yes.
This is Tim Burton's Netflix series Wednesday. Is he directing every episode?
I feel like it never happens, right, that they actually do. I feel like even when it's advertised at the beginning or when the deal is made.
Yeah, it just says right now Burton is directing. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, they always kind of make it sound like the one person's doing all of them. And I feel like that's happened vanishingly few times. I think, what's his face who did
that? Mike Flanagan does that. That's about it.
I feel like even Flanagan's thing didn't, I don't think he did every episode of all of those shows that he was like directed the pilot of. There was Park Chan-wook. I feel like he did every episode of that miniseries he did that I never saw, but should because he's awesome.
Yeah, I need to watch that too. Is it like the drummer girl or something?
Yeah, little drummer boy or some little drummer girl. I don't know what it was. I want to watch that. But I think he did every episode. Burton, I feel like I did read at the time that he was going to do every episode, and this was kind of, you know, de facto his next movie, you know, except it's not a movie. But I don't know. I feel like every time you hear that, then you get to episode 4 and it's someone else. So who knows? I'm excited though because Jenna Ortega has burnished her reputation as a scream queen, and because Christina Ricci is great. And so, fuck it, I'm in. I don't, you know, it's annoying that they're doing it, but I'm in.
Right on. This sounds weird. Ben Stiller in talks to play Jack Torrance in The Shining stage adaptation. This is for the West End. An eventual move to Broadway is expected. King's classic horror novel is being adapted for the stage by Tony winner Simon Stevens with Ivo van Hove leading the team. Sources say the stage play of The Shining will adhere more closely to the book than the movie, which is probably music to Stephen King's ears because he hates that movie. What do you think about the idea of Ben Stiller being Jack Torrance? That's kind of fun, right?
Yeah, I can see that working. It's funny because his persona, his comic persona, is so predicated on rage and suppression of rage. Yeah.
Can you deal with that?
That's
my Ben Stiller impression.
For me, it's all about him playing Mr. Furious in Mystery Man. I love that movie.
I love that movie.
So good. So I could see that. I mean, I don't know how The Shining works on the stage. It's a weird, you know, it's not like something I would be really that hot to see in general, but it is interesting. It's intriguing casting.
Very intriguing. I will see that if it makes it to Broadway with Ben Stiller. Absolutely. We'll do a horror lifestyle outing, new flesh outing. To the Shining with Ben Stiller. Lena Headey, who you know from Game of Thrones and a lot of movies, is going to step behind the camera and direct a psychological thriller called Violet. The story follows two solo female travelers who immediately hit it off and decide to team up for the next leg of their adventure. As the journey continues, things start to unravel because neither of the women who are who they claim to be. It's described as talented Mr. Ripley and single white female meets Killing Eve. You know when it has that many comparisons. Executives are going hog wild for that movie. They love it. So Lena Headey directing was interesting. I'm pretty sure didn't Justine Bateman make a movie called Violet last year?
Yeah, starring Olivia Munn. I have not seen, despite
I liked
Olivia Munn fun fandom. Yeah, I heard it was interesting. I wanted to check it out.
It's pretty good. You should definitely check it out. Okay. I hate when movies have the same name as other movies, so that's really annoying. Did you know that Godzilla vs. Kong will film in Australia this year? Did you hear that?
I heard that from my pal Nathaniel, because we talk about what's going on with Godzilla versus Kong or any other MonsterVerse things all the time. But I had not heard that like from the trades, and so I didn't know that they were. I had heard that they were doing an Apple series and that they might eventually do a sequel, but I didn't know that. I didn't think I really knew that they were planning to make a sequel so soon. I'm all for it because I'm sure the series will be fun, but I want movies, goddammit. So
yeah. It is expected to film at the Gold Coast in Australia and other locations in southeast Queensland, marking the third time a MonsterVerse title has been shot in the region. Godzilla vs. Kong and Skull Island filmed there. The currently untitled sequel will receive $16 million from the federal government's CAX incentive program, and then another $6.3 million subsidy. So all that shit's already in the works, which means this movie is farther along in production than like anybody thought. So that's interesting. And I'm pretty sure, didn't Adam Wingard get confirmed as doing it immediately?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So good for Adam Wingard getting shit done. Spider-Man No Way Home, just wanted to mention, it's still in theaters. It's just reached 800 million domestic on its 101st day of release, while also breaking the record for units sold on DVD or Blu-ray, whatever they count now. Not Blu-ray and digital. It's actually just digital, not even home video yet. It sold 2.1 million units on digital, which roughly translates to $42 million just on digital in its first week. Wow. So, as we talked about earlier, Sony's never, ever letting go of this.
From their cold, dead hands.
From their cold, dead fucking hands. Speaking of cold, dead hot dog hands, let's talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once. First off, because I want to make you talk about Master for way longer. Did we see this together? We did.
Yes, we did. We saw
along
it
with Yahoo Rumble. Entertainment's Ethan Alter.
Yes. Yes. We saw it on a double feature with Uma.
Oh yeah, we had a double feature with like an hour and a half in between or something. I read a book in the park.
I got a burger in between to prepare myself for the and went grocery shopping. Anyway, that's the Harry Knowles what the fuck I did on my the hours leading up to the movie thing. Yeah, so this movie is from Daniels, the directing team behind Swiss Army Man, a movie I was really with until I was not when I saw it back in whenever.
Boy, I was never with that movie. But I want to mention that I hated that movie, but one of those two Daniels, Daniel Scheinart, directed a movie I loved a few years after that called The Death of Dick Long that is very underseen, that is an A24 movie that got barely any release. And I love that movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. I feel like the last chunk of Swiss Army Man, we'll get into this, I think, with Everything Everywhere All at Once, because I think it has kind of a similar issue. I was sort of into I think it took me a little while to get into Swiss Army Man. It's the movie where Paul Dano plays a guy who's sort of shipwrecked and finds a corpse played by Daniel Radcliffe and sort of imagines him becoming his friend or something. It took me a little while to acclimate to it, and then I kind of found it weirdly, Michel Gondry-ish and odd and sort of almost touching. And then it kind of goes to the way it ends, I just didn't quite feel like it really nailed it. This movie is similarly sort of magical realist. It's about Evelyn, played by Michelle Yeoh, who is, owns a laundromat, but is, you know, getting in trouble with some tax problems. Her marriage to her longtime marriage is not doing great. Her husband is thinking of divorcing her. And she has a kind of fraught relationship with her daughter. Her husband's played by Kei Huai Quan from Goonies and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. He played Short Round and Data in those movies. And Stephanie Hugh plays her daughter. And Jamie Lee Curtis is in this. James Hong is in this. But those are the sort of the main, you know, the three family members. And she learns that of the multiverse where she's like approached by someone who, it's a very hard movie to explain, right? Like she,
yeah, it's hard to explain her husband, unless you've seen Rick and Morty. And then I can just say it is an episode of Rick and Morty. It is interdimensional cable. It's an interdimensional cable bit the whole time. But go on and explain it.
No, I was going to say, I haven't seen Rick and Morty, so it's hard for me to explain. It's, I likened it to sort of Futurama-esque where, you know, her husband, when they're at the tax office, turns to her and is like, I'm actually someone from another universe. You're needed to help fight this amassing evil that's been going through all these other universes and all these other yous. And you can sort of jump into these different universes and gain their knowledge. It's also sort of like the Jet Li movie, The One, right? Where there's like parallel universes and the Jet Li is going through and killing all the other versions of himself and gaining their power when he does so. So he's becoming kind of unstable.
Yeah, that movie rocks.
Yeah, it's just kind of, I like that movie. Jason Statham's in it, it's good stuff. So this is kind of like that. This is sort of the sort of more humanist, less action-y version of that, where Michelle Yeoh's character is kind of hopping into different universes and trying to absorb the skills and experiences she's had in these other guises to help herself fight off this evil that is trying to kill her and trying to kill everyone, basically. So it's a trip. I mean, it's a wild movie. It has some like legit action sequences. It has some very Michelle Gondry like touches in terms of what the other universes are. It has so many pop cultural things. There's like a Wong Kar Wai riff like ongoing in it. There's a Pixar riff ongoing in it. And
there's the Super Smash Brothers noises in it. Like there's so many Easter eggy things throughout. It's just it's a spectacle. Yeah. I guess.
There's an uncommented upon running gag about a early 2000s alt rock radio hit that I just slayed me. It was like they were thinking about putting this gag in just for me. So for a lot of this movie, I was just really vibing with it. I mean, I found it very funny, very inventive. It was kind of doing all the stuff I liked about Swiss Army Man and not doing any of the stuff that I found questionable about it. Maybe that's to do with Paul. I feel like nothing against Paul Dano, who's a good actor. Paul Dano, whatever you say it. But I feel like
Paul Drano.
I feel like he's always starting. My friend Nathaniel and I talked about this. He's always kind of starting from scratch with us. Like we see him in a movie and we're like, oh, this guy. And then over the course of the movie, you're like, you know what? He's good. He's all right. He's a good actor. I kind of forget because he looks kind of, you know, he has that kind of like punchable face or whatever, as you, whatever you call it. And then by the next movie, you see him again and you're just, for some reason, you're back at square one going, ah, this fucking guy. I don't know why. Makes him good for playing the Riddler and stuff. But anyway, that's just to say that this movie stars Michelle Yeoh, who you like immediately, like no matter how much of a fuck up her character is. She's just, you know, innately likable and holds the screen perfectly. So that probably helped him a lot. And Kei Huai Quan, I hope I'm saying his name remotely correctly, who we haven't seen on screen, obviously. I think he's done a movie or two here or there the last 5-10 years. Mostly he's been working on stunt coordinating and fight coordinating, I guess, in the meantime, since he was a kid actor, and which is so cool to think about. And he's great, too. I really loved him in this. He's playing
he's really great.
Mild-mannered husband who is nonetheless sort of feeling like he's reaching the end of what this marriage can do. He's really lovely in the movie, and Stephanie Hugh I thought was also really good and funny, and as the sort of, you know, she's a daughter who dates women and thinks her parents and especially grandfather will have trouble accepting that, and has a very fraught relationship, as I said, with her mom. All that stuff really helped carry this movie for a long time, but boy, by the end of it, I really felt, I hate to say this, a little bit worn out. By the 2 hours and 26 minutes. And I don't even, I mean, it was not as, I didn't feel as burned by it as I did by Swiss Army Man. And I don't want to say a lot about the plot because it's really some of the fun is how inventively it unfolds. But, and it's not the kind of, I didn't feel exhausted by the movie's weird sci-fi action inventions. I think I rolled with that pretty well and had like a great time with a lot of it. But when the kind of same with Swiss Army Man, when it time comes for it to get a little more emotional and sort of hit that landing, I just feel like it really goes on. It really kind of rambles on, I would say, even in terms of like giving long speeches and having to intercut a lot of different worlds and kind of like, it just feels
and
like,
man, yeah. Things I found so funny earlier in the movie, like even minutes earlier, they just beat into the ground by the end. I was like, come on.
Yeah. I liked a lot of the running gags the first five times, but then it's also part when they try to
string it together. Yeah.
Yeah. String it together in a way that is going to be emotionally satisfying. And like in the very end, it is like, I do think
yes,
the end
it
the movie
sticks
works.
The ultimate landing ultimately, but like yeah. It takes like a 45 minute detour for no reason.
Yeah. It just really, really goes on. And that sounds maybe more negative about it than I really am, because I did enjoy it a lot. And I imagine I will watch it again at some point. My wife's going, I'm kind of jealous. My wife's going to go see it in IMAX on like Tuesday night.
Yeah, that sounds fun. We saw it in a screening room from the front row. It felt like IMAX.
Yeah, right. And it's cool. It's playing once a night at the 68th Street Real Deal IMAX in Manhattan, which is cool. So I really, you know, it's really great to look at, and it's funny and crazy. It's just like, it really asks a lot of you to say, okay, sit tight, it's the 2 hour mark, and we're gonna like slowly ramp up the emotional climax of the movie, and there's gonna be several different emotional confrontations, several different speeches that kind of blur together. It gets really to be kind of too much. I just feel it's one of those things where a really concise single scene, or however many two scenes or whatever, you know, some smaller number of scenes that is shorter and less flowery would have really hit me hard emotionally. And this movie kind of goes on to the wedding toast kind of feel, where it's going on and wants to include everybody. And, you know, it's like a nice instinct. I just think it kind of gets away from them at the very, you know, in the last 30 minutes of it. And again,
well,
like
that's that's a big problem. I agree with you. Everything you said so far, we're like 100% in sync on this movie. I hate to use the dumbest pun that everyone who reviews this movie will say, but there is a universe where this movie clocks in at like 99 minutes and it's my favorite movie of the year. Like there's so much good shit in here that I think, you know, if these guys were, they must have a great contract. You know what I mean? Like they clearly have Final Cut. Uh-huh. A24 just doesn't mess with shit, I guess, generally speaking. Right. But like, this is one of those cases where like this movie, this version of this movie plays like the unwieldy extended cut, like that the fans only demanded, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like
right.
That they'd put out on DVD 15 years after it came out.
Yeah.
Like it's just so unwieldy. And I do think the emotional through line and core is really strong. And as we both agree, it does stick that landing in a fun way. But God, it really, really wore me out. Like I really, really liked it too. And then it hit a point where I was like, okay, this is exhausting. And then it became excruciating. the thing that I don't want to harp on this movie too much, because I also liked it, and it's going to sound like we're very negative, because there's just so much to nitpick about. It's just frustrating to me.
Yeah.
Because, like, I want it to be the movie that the five-star movie that a lot of our, you know, colleagues are saying it is. But, like, you really have to, like, put aside a lot of problems to accept that this movie is, like, a five-star experience. But, like, that's fine. I appreciate if you had an emotional response to this movie and get it. But there's also the people that I just have to call out, the reviews that are, like, it's the most original, inventive idea you've ever seen. And, like, I just fully think if anything, this movie's more derivative than anything else. It's like, to me, it's very clear these guys love Rick and Morty. And like, if they don't, I'm sorry, but it seems like very clear that they do. And like, didn't I Heart Huckabees do the rock bit?
I don't remember it well enough, but like, to me, like, this, Yeah. I would just say it plays like it's kind of this to balance out me sounding negative on it, even though I like really enjoyed like three quarters of this movie and liked other things about the remaining one quarter. I'll say something that sounds like more of a compliment. It's kind of like Michel Gondry directing The Raid, because so much of it is like in this single building with the like action stuff.
Yeah, and an IRS office.
Yeah. And the but then the kind of weird tangential stuff and like the kind of music video-y touches, you know, the world where everyone has hot dog style hands, fingers. It was like very Michel Gondry. And it's neat to see Michel Gondry's influence coming out. It's not a guy I necessarily would think would influence a lot of movies, but there were, I don't remember, there's some other movie I saw in the past couple of years where I was like, oh, Gondry, it feels like they really, this guy's, I really like Gondry. And I do too. He's one of my faves. So, I mean, like, it is The Raid, Michel Gondry directing The Raid is how this felt to me cinematically. And, but, like, The Raid is also kind of exhausting, you know? Like, I like it a lot, but, like, you kind of feel like, Jesus Christ, this is, it's like, a, this is a lot by the end of it. And this one, kind of, it does, it's very true to that feeling. And I think a lot of people find that about Gondry, too, sometimes. They're just like, oh, you know, overdosing on the whimsy or whatever. But his movies are never 2 hours and 25 minutes long. And I hate to harp on running time, even, because that doesn't seem...
Well, like... it's just, it speaks to the sloppiness of the movie.
Yeah.
It's not even... Yeah, I don't know. Like, messy, it's messy, too, but sloppy is a better word, I think. Because, like, it's just... It hits a point where, you know, I think my friend called it Chekhov's butt plug. And it's like, you know, their sense of humor is just like, I appreciate the juvenileness of it. And like that it is fun to see such silly shit in like ostensibly this, you know, fancy movie. But I don't know. There's something about it that is the crudeness or it's not the crudeness or the crassness of it that bothers me. It's like that's what they find funny that bothers me.
Yeah, and like the kind of look how subversive and like and you know tee hee funny we're being. And I think so. As I was looking this up, I was like, wait, was this movie 225? I'm actually not sure if it was because it's one of those things where
it sure as hell is.
I thought it was 212 because like different places have it listed different ways. And sometimes
I see it listed as 219.
It's so funny. I wonder if there were different, you know, cuts submitted at different times.
IMDb says 212.
Yeah, IMDb and New York Times both say 212. Like Google, which is often just like
either one feels right. 212. Yeah. Well, it feels more like the 220 to me.
Yeah,
but like 212 is too long too.
Yeah, well, that's my point is that it's less about the number than I would believe this movie was 225. It kind of feels it. Even if it is actually only 212. And it's not like, oh, it needs to be not over this certain amount. It's just more about how the movie kind of keeps expanding at a time where you're kind of like, wait, but doesn't this need to start wrapping up? You know, it's that kind of, you almost want to give it the hook at some point while you're still having a great time. But it is really fun and worth seeing.
It's fun and I want people to see it in theaters, but I don't want, I just like to temper expectations, which I will be doing on the Lost City bonus episode big time. Because like, I think if you go into this expecting the best movie of the year, you're going to be disappointed. If you go into it expecting a fun, silly movie that is a little overlong, you'll probably have a great time.
Yeah.
I just think, I don't know what else to say about it without like getting into specifics, but it's funny how didn't you find it funny how, first of all, we saw it back to back with Uma, which was a great double feature thematically, but even Turning Red and The Lost Daughter, there's like all these movies lately about mother-daughter relationships that are basically like mom wants to kill daughter or daughter wants to kill mom.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And that stuff did largely work for me in this. But I am a little surprised.
But that speaks to the platitudinous of it all to me, too, is that all these recent movies have said the same thing. And like, everyone's praising this movie for being so original. I'm just like, no, it just kind of reheated all these other ideas, but they're all in one movie. So you think it's new.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I'm at with it.
I did kind of feel watching it so in such close proximity to Turning Red. Not that you can't have more than one movie about a fraught Asian American, you know, mother-daughter relationship. But I really love Turning Red. So seeing this like a week later and not thinking it was quite as good, even though it goes on for much longer, did make me feel like, oh, okay, well, this Turning Red really got me emotionally and this one did not as much. It just feels like I feel like that felt that way about Swiss Army Man. I was just kind of like, I don't think these guys are always, the Daniels are necessarily in full control. That's how I feel about like Ari Aster sometimes too. That like, I'm not sure if they know exactly, not that they don't know what they're doing. I mean, that sound like they're bumbling idiots or anything, because they're obviously very savvy and talented guys.
Yeah.
It just, they sometimes feel like the movie gets out of their control. And I think that's part of the design even.
Well, I mean, the very title of the movie makes it like impenetrable to criticism. You know what I mean? They're like, well, yeah, the movie called Everything Everywhere All at Once is a little unwieldy. Like, of course it is. Yeah. Like, it's by design. You could totally say that. But I agree with you completely. I just think it's sloppy and no one told them no. And again, as I said, there's a version of this movie that I really love if they like saw the edges off. But like, to me, it feels like, you know, A24's Adult Swim, Looney Tunes, The Matrix with like Scott Pilgrim-y fights in there. Like, it's just an amalgam of many things. So anyone watching this and seeing it as like a beacon of originality, that's, I guess I'm jealous. Like, I wish I could experience it that way. But I just found it so much to be, you know, inspired by its influence or wearing its influence on its sleeve, so to speak. But like, there are some visual gags that really work, like the pinky finger with a bicep muscle, I remember in my mind as a funny moment. Like, it's just, there's a reason Rick and Morty episodes are 22 minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I also want to commend them. It's a weird thing to like just scoff at it and say, yeah, Rick and Morty did it. Because like, that's a cartoon. You can do anything in a cartoon. And they did translate what should have been hard to make into a movie, like a cartoony thing, into a movie that is inventive looking and cool looking and visually pleasing, even if I was annoyed with the aspect ratio shit at a certain point.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. Like, I want to commend them for making a live action cartoon, but it's also just too much. but it looks good. And I think these guys are clearly very fucking talented. And they did, before all those movies you mentioned, they did a lot of really iconic music videos. And you should look up all those. They're really cool. But like, this movie has a joke where like, literally a joke about like, the universe is an everything bagel. Like, that to me is such like, I don't know how to describe it, like weird online humor that doesn't work for me, where it's like everything bagel. What if everything included everything? It's just like, that's a joke I've heard before. And to see it in a movie and people laughing at it like it's the funniest thing in the world was annoying. I think also we saw it with a really annoying crowd and that didn't help.
I don't remember anything about the crowd. Oh, yeah, no, yeah, I remember one thing.
Oh, sure you sure fucking do remember.
Yeah, someone there was using a fucking light-up pen.
There was a person behind us that I would say it was less a light-up pen and more of like a lighthouse that she brought in. That was like a beacon of light that would illuminate the whole three-road room. Everyone clearly infuriated with this woman, and no one said anything.
Yeah.
But that was annoying. But also, like, it just got huge laughs. And I'm just like, I don't know. Clearly, this movie annoyed me a little bit. But, like, I also kind of liked it. And that's enough on that. Now for me to get really annoyed and heated. I'm going to let Jesse start with this is kind of what I thought was the common take, which is that this movie sucks and is embarrassing and is not a horror movie and is just about social commentary, blah. So, Jesse, take it away. What is Master?
I feel bad. I feel like if we really should have had you praise it and then have me dissent. But
I can, if you want. I can do that.
Yeah. Why don't you talk about what you liked? I don't want to lead and say, blah, this.
Well, it's easier for me to nitpick that way. But I will I'll do that. That's fine. So Master is a movie that is ostensibly about the experience of two black women at like a prestigious elite New England college, like a very white institution, like a Harvard, like it's a fake Harvard type of place.
It's a little more like small liberal arts feel. It's like one of those places that like you think it's like probably like Haverford or something or Swarthmore or something. I don't know.
Yeah. So it's this low key movie. I'm going to go ahead and call it horror adjacent and not call it a horror movie, because that is, I think, why a lot of people are upset with it. Maybe I'm just trying to parse it, because I don't think it's the Craven Antebellum level movie that a lot of people say it is.
No, I wouldn't say it's that. It's definitely not Antebellum or Alice, to another recent horrible movie that tries to do this stuff. So I'll give it that.
Basically, it's about a girl who's a freshman at this college and her experience as a young black woman at this school, juxtaposed against Regina Hall, who is the first black like master, which is like a high position at the school, like a master of a house. So it's like kind of juxtaposing their two experiences and all the like, you know, daily microaggressions that people of color would have to endure in this type of environment. And I thought, maybe again, it's just because I was expecting so much far worse out of the reaction at Sundance, but I thought this was really impressive and effective with really good atmosphere and strong performances. And I initially didn't really care for the wrinkle that the final twist added to the movie, but I did appreciate it throwing another big idea into the mix, even if it's late in the game and underdeveloped. I found it to be like a primal scream of a movie that announces itself as such with a scene that has a primal scream in it, as such immediately. And it delivers on that. It's never subtle and it's not trying to be. And I just thought it was a really good movie. Like I found the sequence where like the girl, the main girl, is at the frat party and dancing for the first time. And like, just for, first of all, the way like all the dudes start ogling her in that scene, but also that scene then cuts from like some dance song to like some hardcore rap song, where this black girl is on the dance floor at a college party, and all these like angry looking, partying, big, bulky white dudes are bouncing around on the dance floor with like this, you know, strobe red light, because it's a horror movie, and they're basically yelling the N-word at her because it's in the song. And that to me sums up the horror of this movie and why I think it's a great horror movie in a way that, you know, not your typical, it's a horror movie with jump scares and ghosts and ghouls and stuff. And I think the movie kind of errs when it tries to bring that stuff into it, but I think it's really strong on that level of like the microaggression-y stuff. And just watching this black girl go through college and how she has to not only like, you know, deal with her white classmates, but also a black teacher who isn't really like an ally to her in a way that she, you know, you might expect she would be. And like how it's basically a horror movie about like black excellence and like how people of color have to strive to be better than everybody else and how much harder it is and how like the daily grind they have to go through and shit they have to ignore to get through that. And I thought there were like, I watched it again. I rarely would want to watch a movie like this again, but I was so taken with it. And I was so shocked by you and Marissa also not liking it that I rewatched it again to make sure that I wasn't crazy. And I'm standing by it. I thought this was a really strong movie. I think it tries to bite off a little more than it can chew at the end. But after a second viewing, I actually think I got a better read on what they were going for. And I thought it was fine. And all this from like a debut filmmaker, a young black woman, like, I think this is a great movie. I really do. Now, what? Why are you? Why do you hate black people?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, so I don't disagree with some of what you're saying about it. I do think some of it is effective. I think structurally, the director, Mariama Diallo, does something really smart and cool with the way that she cross cuts between Regina Hall's character and Zoe Renee's character, who's the Zoe Renee plays the young freshman.
Jasmine, yeah.
Yeah. And Regina Hall is the woman who's, you know, a more lofty, she's a professor who's also in kind of like a lofty position, recently elevated to a loftier position at the school. And the two of them seeing their experiences sort of juxtaposed is really interesting. And it kind of made me just wish this had been more of a genuine social drama. But the thing is,
like the first 45 minutes, I'd say, are really good. Like that of this.
Yeah, I mean, I was like intrigued. I wouldn't even necessarily say really good, because I do think this movie, more than you're letting on, is trying to do horror stuff, like earlier on than it sounds like There is like this whole kind of mythology about whether
there's a very clear to me on the second viewing MacGuffin that the first time through you think is going to be like a payoff and it doesn't. Yeah. And I'm assuming you're talking about the Salem witchy shit.
Yeah, there's like a an idea that someone was that might haunt the dorms or whatever, and then and Jasmine, Zoe Renee's character, does start feeling like she's experiencing something otherworldly, and she's like losing time, or is a little freaked out, and her roommates, of course, her roommate is no help. They have kind of an antagonistic, racially charged by the horrible white people in the movie relationship. The thing is, I think the reason I reacted so negatively to this movie is that, and that scene you mentioned is really good with her at the party, that dynamic. Although that's a dynamic I feel like I have seen depicted in other movies.
I've never seen it depicted in a way that made me feel that the way that scene made me feel.
Yeah, it does a good job of kind of putting you in her, her point of view.
Yes.
But I think it uses a lot of its horror touchstones as a way, sort of shortcut to not really exploring this material as much as it could. I don't think it really has enough character to be a character study of either of these people, because they're so heavily defined by the way the white people define them in the movie. And I don't think that's because the director is like defining them that way. No, I think it's really because Diallo is, by trying to make this sort of a horror movie, I just did not find remotely effective. It's not scary. It's like, now it's, like you said, this kind of creepiest stuff in the movie is the stuff that's not horror. And like, you can say, oh, there's a reason for that intellectually, but like, that's what my old writing group is called, the imitative fallacy, where you say, oh, well, but it's like that on purpose. So it's like, right. But if you're still experienced, like, it's like saying a movie's boring on purpose. You're like, well, I'm still bored watching it. Can't, evoking boredom by being boring is not actually good, writing. And this movie, I kind of felt similarly. I was like, yeah, being like jerked around by the horror stuff for a point still means I'm being jerked around. And I think I'm going to try carefully, because I don't want to sound like I'm saying, oh, like the white characters had no, like weren't weren't interested, because obviously that's not what this movie's about at all. But I was just thinking about Get Out, which is probably reductive, but I do think is why a lot of these movies are allowed to get made. And I think it's a great compliment to Get Out that it's able to, it's inspired so many movies in such a short period. And it is really a classic, like an instant classic. Whenever I see a bad one, I think, again, like, oh, well, this really does, if nothing else, this confirms that Get Out was an instant classic. But in that movie, like the white characters are obviously not like the dimensionalized characters, or the ones who you are, the kind of antagonistic white characters are not who you feel for, and not, they don't really have a lot of depth or dimension, but they are so memorable and so well played and have such a range from the kind of, smiley, passive aggressive creepiness of the Bradley Whitford character to the Allison Williams really toying with her, like, extreme white girl image, and like seeming so sympathetic despite that, and then having that amazing flip at the end that's so creepy with the car keys and everything, and Catherine Keener being like genuinely menacing and scary. This movie has none of that in its side characters. There's no, I mean, it's just like, especially with Regina Hall's plot, where she's with the all the, kind of clueless white faculty who are trying their best to be super woke, but also obviously unable to overcome their own racism. Great dynamic to depict. I mean, that's, I think some of that stuff is spot on. But the characters are just such loathsome cartoons that I just...
Well, they're archetypes. They're not... Yeah,
yeah, but it's not... Okay, so I didn't find that funny because it was too obvious. I didn't find it scary because that's not like what's really pitched as the scary stuff in this movie. Some of the scarier stuff does work pretty well for Jasmine, Zoe Renee's character. But so I just felt like those scenes are just, to me, a slog of like, oh, do you get it that the white faculty are stupid and racist? And I was like, yeah, I do get that. This is something I understand. And it just, get poor Regina Hall, who's always terrific, and she does her best here. It just is given no one to play off of. And the other character, the other black professor, is so transparently, I thought, transparently used for a very particular plot purpose that I did not, not to put too fine a point on it, like mentally suggest, I was like, I wouldn't say, oh, I called it, but like, I would say half an hour into this movie, I said, about something, and it was like, and I was correct. And it, Again, that's not necessarily a problem. You know, like, that doesn't mean that I'm super smart or that the movie's super dumb. It's just something that happens sometimes when a movie's playing fair with that stuff. So I don't even think it was like, oh, I called it, so it's bad. It was just like, it was obvious. And it made that character, the character dynamics feel kind of contrived and to me kind of plastic and not really, you know, deeply felt or like really digging into the kind of emotional horror of it. And I do think Jasmine's section of the movie does that a little better, but then the movie kind of sacrifices her section of the movie to the kind of horror trappings. Again, it just kind of all feels like it's done to make a point. And I didn't feel like I was getting I just didn't feel like I was getting to know these characters beyond what the machinations of the movie, what the movie's trying to do. And then what the movie's trying to do to me was signaled very early and repeated very often. So like the big turn at the end, which I actually think is an interesting idea for either a campus drama or even a horror movie. It just felt so telegraphed to me that I was not, and even the way the movie plays it is not in a way that's dramatically like, whoa, it's just like everyone kind of underreacts to it. Which I guess I appreciate that they're not that it's mind blowing or something. But then I was kind of like, then why the fuck did I watch all this? Like to be like lectured about something in a kind of dull, like mildly creepy way with a few good scenes for sure. And I enjoyed the structure. And I don't think it's like a complete botch like Antebellum. It's much less pleased with itself in that movie. It's less obviously made by at least one white person in the way that Antebellum is. And I think Alice also was directed by a white woman. And I was like, no fucking kidding, it was. But so, you know, it's not quite that level of terrible. But it really just did not work for me. It just felt to me like it's not a good campus drama and it's not a good horror movie. So what's left except for me to be impressed that they're raising these issues? And I just was not that impressed.
That is the general take I've seen that I completely disagree with. Like, I would say, I guess I'm trying to get at what's the difference between our reactions. And I think it's that you found the horror tinged elements like annoying where I found or like and taking a just not effective where I found them effective. Like, I guess like I love the way that the movie is basically equating like the juxtaposition to the two stories to me. Jasmine's is more supernatural, right?
Yeah.
And Regina Hall's story is more just like the actual social commentary stuff. And I love the idea of portraying the daily horrors of being a young black freshman at a white college as a horror movie. I just think it worked. It just worked for me on the level of like, that's a fun idea. And then I just thought the way the scenes played out, again, it's never the scary scenes. And like, I didn't think those scenes were bad because I saw them as like window dressings as like, ooh, this is her horror movie she's starring in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, for example, I think the first microaggression she gets is when she gets back to her dorm room and there's a bunch of guys in there and they're like, who is this? Is this what, Beyonce, Venus Williams, Serena Williams, Lizzo? They just make all these jokes about black girl names. And then there's another scene where she orders pizza for everyone and then goes to pick up the pizza outside and like, you know, it's $20 and she just very calmly asks everyone to pay her back and like they don't pay her back.
That second scene maybe a little more. That first one, like, I mean, I don't doubt that people experience something like that, but I was like, that doesn't even, if you're making a movie about microaggressions, I feel like that's just aggression.
But that's the point. I think that's another fundamental disconnect between us on this movie is that like, I found all the interactions with white people on the level, honestly, from my experience in college and, you know, growing up where I grew up and having parents the age I do, you know what I mean? Like, I just... That's another reason why this movie really works for me is like I found all of the interactions with white people to be, especially on Regina Hall's side, like the way, you know, they call her Barack and shit. Again, that's all very Get Out-y.
Yeah.
But it didn't read to me as false or like I'm not getting enough from these characters because I just understood what the movie was trying to get at.
Like, it's to me, it's like it's not that they ring false. Certainly, I have no doubt that people have experienced this and worse.
Yeah,
at both of these levels that the student and the teacher are dealing with, it's more that, like, again, to the like imitative fallacy thing, it's like, yeah, but like, it's not interesting to me. Like, I didn't feel like I was learning something about that experience because I've seen those kind of things depicted before, and there's no like emotional betrayal to it because you don't care about any of them in the first place. Like, it's not this movie's fault that it's not Get Out, but Get Out has this really fraught situation of like a guy with a girlfriend he loves and the family he wants to get along with, and then having to navigate that is like, and then especially when the family seems at first well-meaning, is like so prickly because someone's saying something pretty racist or stupid to you, and like, what, you know, you aren't in a position where you can call them out really. And you're telling yourself how they mean well, and like, my girlfriend's smarter than this at least. And then so that betrayal is like so scary, and like feeling, you know, that kind of trapped feeling. And they really did a great job in that movie of making that happen. In this, it just seems like the shot is called so early. There's never a feeling like, oh, maybe she's going to be friends with this girl. I guess at the early, and then like, it's not so clumsy that they never have a moment of friendliness. There are some, you know, moments when she's like playing a drinking game with her roommate and other people in the hall early on. You think maybe, I mean, you know, obviously that's not where this movie is going, but like they allow a little bit of humanity to feel like, then when she's kind of betrayed by them emotionally, it does kind of feel like, ooh, that's pretty nasty. But both with the professors and with the other students, they're just so obviously, for the most part, like, you know, the white establishment, that I'm not saying, oh, why is she so upset? Of course it would be upsetting. I just mean, as a viewer, maybe I would be really interested in seeing someone who was in Zenobia Renee's character's position as like a black woman at an Ivy school or Ivy level school.
Yeah.
And how, if they found it enlightening, or if it was just like, well, you're serving this back, like my experience back to me and saying, whoa, like see how it is. And I really don't know. I mean, I'm sure it varies from person to person. But I just kind of felt like, okay, yeah, the dynamic here is very established very early, and it is probably well observed, but there's no place for it to go really. And then when Jasmine makes a certain decision very late,
we'll get into spoiler territory here. Okay, yeah. I want to talk about everything. So you're saying, go ahead.
I just like, she makes a, like, yeah, so this is a spoiler. Towards the end of the movie, Jasmine hangs herself, feeling kind of tortured and pursued both by like the kind of racism and feeling alone, and also, you know, it's again sort of a red herring that maybe she feels like haunted by this, you know, figure. And she's not, the point I think more being that it's not so much, oh, she's being haunted by a ghost, so much as she has no one who will like talk to her or believe her or empathize with her in any way, so she feels so isolated. And I didn't really buy that someone would hang themselves over there. I mean, not that no one would. I just don't buy that this character.
I just think you're too caught up on plot mechanics. I mean, I understand. I understand the criticisms. They're fair. So to me, it's, you know, you're getting hung up on the plot mechanics, which are fair criticisms, fine. But like, I just largely saw it as this movie about three different black women's experiences with black excellence and how that affected them. And like, I love that the Salem witch trial, Margaret, whatever her name is, story, when she researches it, it ends up just being about the first black undergraduate at that school killed herself. And that's what ends up happening to Jasmine. And like, again, they make this point very loudly. There's no subtext. They say it out loud later. But like, it's about how nothing has changed and nothing will change. And this is just the experience of being black in this movie. It's a microcosm, you know, it's a white college, but it's a microcosm of the world at large, of being a black in a white world. And how I saw the witch stuff as like the white people trying to scapegoat it and like find an explanation that's not their own culpability. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, It's not us. It's, there's this witch. And like, I love that idea of like, that is their explanation. And like, there's some, what I really hated the first time was that, the big twist at the end what you said you called was the teacher faking being black. Is that what you called?
Yeah.
That was interesting to me too, because it's about, that's getting at like the white people who pretend to be black because of the perceived, you know, whatever it is, disadvantage or like the phenomenon of white people who want to be black, like Rachel Dolezal. Like that's what it's getting at, those things. But like the movie's also saying like, yes, this black teacher getting tenure is a win for diversity, and the school, that's something they're going to tout, right? But she only got tenure in this situation because the school felt bad because a black girl had just died.
Yeah.
So to me, that all of that is just getting at, pretty clumsily maybe, but getting at the idea of white people using blackness to their advantage and self-advancement.
Yeah, there's like the optics, like it's literally optics because this person appears to be black but is not.
So
that's,
like,
that's okay. I mean, I think that's, that could be really great material for a more incisive movie. I just like, I do any of these points, to me it's not plot mechanics, to me it's character. It just feels like all these characters are in service of this like list of kind of talking points, which I agree with, like, completely, but I did not find them entertaining or interesting, mostly, as depicted in this movie. There were times where I felt like, okay, I'm getting into the experience of what it's like to be Jasmine or what it's like to be Gail, Regina Hall's character. But for the most part, I just felt like I was being jerked around right up into, like, you're in Jasmine's point of view, and I just do not feel like the character is written in a way where I was like, oh yeah, like, they really take you every step of the way to her deciding to hang herself. Like, I just don't, that to me just felt like, not plot mechanics that I think are, oh, you know, oh, this isn't logical, so much as like the character mechanics aren't logical, and it kind of serves a plot more than it serves character. And I always kind of, I tend to prefer stuff that serves character over plot.
Yeah, we could argue all day, I guess, because I don't know. I see where you're coming from, but I can't believe I watched it twice and still felt the way I did. I just think, I also love, like, it gets into like the Shining style ending where like time starts to collapse and she starts seeing like the people from the past, and like that really gets at the point of like nothing's changed and nothing will. I just think,
gets that it's all right. Explicitly says it. No, I mean, those are some neat touches, but I feel like in a movie, I kind of just wish the horror, I mean, this is kind of prescriptive, but I kind of wish the horror in this movie was a little more amped up and a little almost broader, just because like it is broad, like it is not, like you said, it's not subtle, which is not a problem. So you don't have to be subtle for something to be good, but if it's not going to be subtle, I think this is an unsubtle movie thinking it's really sneaking up on you, and I would rather just be unsubtle and like make it a real horror movie, or make it like something genuinely thorny. Like I was, for some whatever reason, I was thinking of the movie Loose, which is not really about the same issues. I don't know if you saw that one with
I did, Anderson. Yeah,
I love that movie. And in the beginning of this movie, there were elements of it where I was like, oh, this kind of feels like that, just in terms of like, you know, kind of what is ambiguous about the characters, but also what is, you know, these very fraught dynamics. And I think I would have been up for something like a Loose style campus drama with like these kind of layers and kind of conflicting whatever. And to me, this just kind of felt, I hesitate to say easy, but that's kind of what it felt to me. Like they didn't risk anything in terms of what they're saying, and they're not risking anything in terms of the style of it, which is, you know, very tasteful horror. So maybe it was more as a horror thing that I just didn't feel like it worked, but you know, I'm glad it worked for you. Like, I don't think this isn't, like I said, this isn't like Antebellum or something where I would be like, Jesus Christ, like it's not going to go on my worst of the year list by any stretch.
Yeah.
And you know, it's free on Amazon Prime if you have that, so it's like not it's worth checking out maybe, but like and Marissa liked it a little more than I did and found the campus stuff a little more compelling than I did. I just feel like I need more at this stage. Like,
I mean, if I have one thing to knock, it's that it has like the festival chapter title bullshit, which is annoying. But I mean, there's that scene where there's a tour of the white people going through the hallway and they're all like turning to gawk at her.
There's moments
Scene, the recruitment video for like the diversity or whatever. Like, I don't know, man. I understand that people are gonna think it's just like too on the nose, too much, but, and it does just telegraph everything and go there, but I found it super effective, and I think, I don't know, there's definitely a case to be made on both sides. So you should decide. You should watch it on Amazon Prime. It's like, I don't know. The two stories parallel, one's supernatural, one's social commentary. I understand it shouldn't work, and I would argue most people argue it doesn't, but I think it did work for me. And like, the movie's just so earnest, I found, and like, I thought that the performances and the earnestness kind of like outweighed my problems with it, and like, I just really liked it. I think it's more that I saw it pan. If I hadn't seen it pan so much, I don't know if I would be so positive on it. But because I did, I just was like, yeah, this is good, and I want to encourage people to watch it. So, curious your thoughts on Master. Let us know.
Yeah, let us know.
Brett Redacted on Twitter, Rock Marooned on Twitter. I wish I could. Maybe I'll plug in the Oscar winners, my bets, how much I won here, to let you guys know if I have to sell my house or not. And then check on our Patreon if you want to hear about The Lost City and Apollo 10 and a half ahead of its release. And we'll also talk briefly about The Outfit and Windfall. Okay, bye.
Mom with the new flesh.
I've learned that death is not the end of the new flesh.
Mom with the new flesh.
I was hoping you'd be back.